for members only. Golf Smarter numbers 438 and 439 published on May 27, 2014. This is 2 weeks worth of episodes delivered at once. It's an hour-long conversation, but luckily it's a podcast and you can listen as much or as little as you want starting right now.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Ben Hogan's Secret Letter and the Lost Fundamental Short Game with Tony Manzoni.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Tony.
Hey, great to be back, Fred.
It's great to talk to you. How have you been?
Well, I had a little bit of a mishap. It's kind of funny in a way. I broke three bones in my right foot ankle.
Oh.
By falling from a hill, hit a wet spot and slid downhill, and body weight went forward and right leg didn't want to go forward and it snapped like a twig. So that's been it's been a little setback, but other than that, life is really good. My golf team did well again. We won the 27th conference championship in a row, which is kind of crazy. Each year I just shake my head. I don't know why it keeps happening, but it does.
Do you recruit these kids, or they find you? I mean, you keep winning and winning and winning.
Yeah, we get them from all over. This year we had a bunch of boys out of the country.
Really?
And some of them are really good players, and they're all coming back next year. But I always say to them, how did you find College of the Desert? You're from Belgium. But they go on the website. And if you look at the website, you know, our record really is sensational. And then the area that we're in is such a beautiful area for golf. We've got over 100 golf courses, great weather in spring when we compete. We have a wonderful driving range on the facility. I'm a PGA member. I like to hope that part of them coming is my coaching. And just, the whole package is good for a young person that really wants to get into golf in a serious way. So it works out good.
Yeah, give us more details. More details about the school, where it is, and so people can
The name of the school is College of the Desert. It's in Palm Desert, California. It's a population of about 10,000 students. We have been rebuilding the college. It's built all kinds of new buildings, and the campus is fabulous. And of course, the weather in Palm Desert or the Coachella Valley is second to none, and especially in springtime. So it's just a marvelous place to come to. You know, we have the Coachella Fest and all kinds of activities for young people, but it's just a great place to live. I'm very lucky. I left the Bay Area, and, you know, we all know San Francisco is one of the greatest cities of all time, if not the greatest.
That's why I haven't left.
I do miss it, believe me, but for me in golf and what I had wanted to accomplish, this was probably the best place I could have come to.
Mm. Well, congratulations. You guys have just owned it. And I think it's more of a testimony to your teaching.
I hope it's part of it for sure. I do have a formula that I use every year, and it seems to be working out. And you know, the kids nowadays, you don't really have to teach much when it comes to the movement of the swing. They're all pretty up to date on, you know, they're all into rotation and connection and so forth. So it's not a hard sell. It's not like it was, let's say, 15 years ago where everybody was, you know, more of a hands and arm swinger opposed to a body swinger. So that part is really good.
Well, and we've also had tremendous success. Your book and the video, actually the only place they're really available, are on Golf Smarter. And it's amazing to me what a phenomenal response you've received from the Golf Smarter community.
It is amazing because, you know, I'm a no-name. I'm just a golf professional, although I think that I'm a pretty good teacher. When we did the book, I did it kind of for friends and family and hoping that some people in the golfing community would like it and accept it. And I must say that I'm pleasantly surprised, thanks to your site, too. I mean, you have such a great group of people that are on your site all the time. So That's been a big plus for me, and I enjoy this is a small success, so people out of the country buy it, which is always kind of cool.
And all over the world. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, let's talk about the book and what you cover and what your method is, because it's very effective.
It is. A quick history about 15, 20 years ago, I had a fellow walk in my office and tell me, would you like a copy of a letter that Ben Hogan wrote explaining how to hit the driver? And also, he had some film that was private film that he had taken, and no one had actually seen a Ben Hogan swing. And I almost jumped in his lap. The first thing I did is I read the letter, and the first thing I noticed was that Hogan stated that on the top of the backswing, he has his weight shifts to the instep of his left foot. And when I read it, I thought, well, I think he means the instep of his right foot, because that's what all traditional thinking was. And then I went on to read the letter, and it was really informative, and a lot of stick figure pictures and so forth. And then I watched the film, and it was very obvious that he was staying on his left side throughout the backswing. It looked like he set up a little bit like, I'd say, 60-40. And I think when you really center your head to the golf ball, you must be a little bit more on the left side than the right side. I noticed that his right hip was aligned on the inside of his right foot. So that was his right side brace. And I just noticed that when he swung, he rotated his shoulders around his spine, and his shoulders really were more level than his earlier swings. And the film that I had was after the accident. And that's really when he said, I'm going to start playing off the left side. And the funny thing about that statement, the left side, a lot of people say that, but they don't know what it means. It certainly isn't stack and tilt. A lot of people say, oh, you teach stack and tilt, and I don't. And I'm not speaking against stack and tilt. I just believe that the shoulders really don't tilt on the downswing. I believe they turn based on the way they were set up at the ball. Because when they tilt, it really steepens the swing and the downswing. And it also, the hands must finish much higher. And the body ends up in kind of what we used to call a C position. And people that do that do that a lot end up with lower back problems, as did most of the people from the era that I played in. So I believe in turning more level, as Hogan says, to turn level left and posting up, so that when you finish, your body's really more erect and your weight is really on the left side, and your body isn't tilted back. So when I got all this information, I started applying it to some of the people that I taught, elderly people, who their first complaint was, I want to hit it farther. That seemed to be the number one chant that I got from everyone that I said, well, what would you like to do in the golf swing? Yeah, I want to hit it farther. So I started working with this, and holy mackerel, because I had them more on the left side, I could get them onto the total left side. I get them through the golf ball much easier than when they transferred their weight right and then back to the left. And I readily saw that there was a rationale for doing this. This wasn't a Band-Aid, but this was really the way you did it. And then going back into filming, I saw the Palmers, the Nicklauses, and all the greats. They had long careers. Their head was very steady. Their head did not move to the right in the backswing. So little by little, I started really buying into this. Then I got a call from Al Geiberger, who is a resident here and, of course, a very famous golfer, Mr. 59, we call him. And Al said, when I read your article in the golf magazine, local magazine, I thought you had flipped your wig. He said, but I started doing it with a fellow that was reversing his weight shift all the time. And he said, it worked like a charm. I got him from falling back to the right side, and he is now finishing and hitting the ball really, really great. He said, then I started tinkering it. Now think about this. Al Geiberger was voted as having one of the great golf swings of all time. And he said, because of my age, I can't get to that left side like I used to. And he said, it works like a charm. So that was the kind of the catalyst in the history of how I really bought into this, because I had to buy into it just like everybody else. I was taught, you know, shift your weight to the right, take your sternum and shift your weight to the right leg and then shift back to the left. And, you know, there's a big timing element there because you've got to make a little lateral slide and then rotate. And this eliminates that lateral slide. So then everyone that I taught said, you know, you need to write this in some kind of a book form so other people can see it. And, you know, they were rubbing my elbow pretty hard there. My ego pretty hard there. So I thought, well, what the heck? Why not do that? So I wrote that little periodical. It's a small little book, as you know, but I think it's concise. And I have done this now since the day I got that letter. I have been continuous. I have never stopped doing this. And I can tell you that I have never had anyone say, I can't do it this way. I can't hit it this way. I think this is wrong. Never, not one. And I would tell you, even if there was one, I would tell you. It's never happened. And I've had a lot of guests, by the way, come from your site, that came into town to take a lesson from me. And I must say that I got love letters from them after.
Mm. Yeah, and I've received those letters as well. I've had people in the Golf Smarter community write to me from all over the United States and even outside, I'm pretty sure, who have come to Palm Desert in the Palm Springs area in Southern California to take lessons with you. And we're just so happy of the results.
It really has been astounding. And you can only thank Mr. Hogan, because he was really the one that I think there was other players that played off the left side for sure. In his era, and subsequently some that did after. I mean, Lee Trevino, in a conversation I had with him, said to me, I've seen a lot of guys that had great long careers that played off the left side, but I've never seen anyone that had a long career that played off the right side. And I didn't understand what he was saying. And of course, like most people, I was embarrassed to say, what do you mean by that? But then after I got into this, I certainly understood what he was talking about, and no truer statement can be made. The thing I love about it is that I get women and that have started to play golf later in years, and also men, and they've taken a couple of lessons, and I say, well, you know, you're really not finishing your swing. They say, well, my pro told me to shift my weight, but I just can't do it. And I explained to them, I said, the reason you can't is because your body's in the wrong position at the top of the swing. You're in a place where there's no place to go but to hit off of the right foot, throw your arms at the ball, and just hope that your hands square instead of roll over and close or stay open. And that's why a lot of people, you know, they slice a ball and then they pull a ball, and now they don't know where to go. And it's just primarily because they've put the responsibility of squaring the club head with the hands and arms, and that is tenuous at best. When you do this system, you set up to the ball and you create your triangle with your arms, and you set to the golf ball. You rotate your right shoulder behind your neck, so there's no movement to the right. What you're doing is displacing your weight behind your spine. And in doing that, the right hip and right shoulder go behind you, and you actually add a little bit more weight to the left side. The right arm folds into its throw position simultaneously as the right shoulder turns. So it's a real simple move. You're not trying to take it back low or do all these things that we've been talked about, or cock the wrist here, or don't cock the wrist here. You just take that triangle back with a rotation of your right side behind you and let the right arm fold naturally. And that sets the club, and it's in your throw position, because everybody's in a little different position. If I give you a baseball and say, throw it, Fred, you might throw it from a little different position above your shoulder or below your shoulder than I would. And we're all subject to that. So it's ludicrous to tell someone, okay, you have to put the club here. Because here it doesn't exist. It's depending on their anatomy. And then the next part of it is I don't get involved with where the club head is at the top in the sense of, is my wrist flat or is my wrist cupped? I let the natural hinging of the wrist occur. Some people, it flattens a little bit. Some people, it stays cupped. What really matters is where it's at impact. And I find that, you know, Hogan cupped his wrist like crazy, but at impact, his wrists were flat. And I think that's really not a part of manipulation of the hands. I think that's a part of getting the left side out of the way, keeping the left arm connected across the chest. And let me say this, no matter who you are, if you're a right-handed golfer, when you take the club back, your left arm goes across your chest. So that's not some trickery. That's the only way you can move. And when that left arm goes across the chest, it connects. It connects on top of the pectoral muscle of your left side of your chest. That's where true connection is. So when you take that club back, the right arm folds, the left arm is stretched across the chest. Where that left arm is setting is where it must stay on the first move of the downswing. That's why a lot of people used to put a head cover under their armpit or a handkerchief. That was to keep that left arm from coming down immediately in the downswing. Because once you do that, you are now subject to what your arms can do. You've left your body behind. So all this stuff about dropping the hands first, I mean, I'm not saying that you can't do that, but for the average person, they drop their hands first. They're going to just pull their arms down, and they're going to either hit behind the ball or hit it thin. And if they're lucky, they're going to hit it in the air, but they're not going to hit it with any force because they're only using their arms. They have eliminated their core. Where when you take the club back correctly across the chest, and then you start a rotational move. In other words, you're doing the opposite of what you did on the backswing. You turned on a single axis, which is your left side, and then you rotate around that axis. And that arm stays there. Eventually, the right arm straightens, the club hits the ball. And then as you rotate to the left, and you must, the club follows you back to the left, and the left arm folds, just like the right arm folds on the right side. So it's real simple. It's a simple, simple move. And I have people that come to me that are, you know, ones and two handicaps, 30 handicaps. And they always say, "What? Don't I have to worry about this? Don't I have to worry about that?" I say, "No, you're hitting the ball great, aren't you?" "Yeah." I said, "Golf is like every other sport. There's a domino effect. You make the correct move here, a bunch of good moves happen. You get in the wrong position, I don't care who you are, you're going to have a tough time with the game."
I get frequent questions from listeners asking me about the book and the DVD that you have offered, and want to know your response. Which is better for them to? I always say just buy both. But when somebody wants to study more of The Lost Fundamental, which is the name of the book and the DVD, which are both available in our Golfer Smart at golfsmarter.com, tell me the difference from your perspective of what those two have to offer.
Well, I think that we all learn differently. Some people like to see it, and some people can, when they read it, they can see it. I personally love the book because I can go back and I can put little yellow marks where I think it's important. Because I forget it myself. Believe me, there's a science to this, and even in its simplicity, the sequence has to be correct. When I hit a ball thin or fat, I know that I, first of all, didn't get past the ball. And that's one of the things that I hear all the time. Stay behind the ball. Stay behind the ball. There's no sport that I know of where you don't move through impact. When you throw a punch, when you hit a tennis ball, when you hit a baseball, there's a movement forward. Now, it isn't a straight line movement, but there's a movement past the ball for sure. You got to end up on your left side. So you're rotating around that axis, but past the ball. You want your right shoulder and right hip to go past the golf ball. You don't want to keep it behind. And that's, again, what I see on the driving range all the time. You see people end up with their swing, and they're still back on their right foot. There's a couple of guys on tour that I won't mention that if they understood this and got over a little bit at address on the left side, they wouldn't be hitting off that right side and all of a sudden hit it a fairway left or a fairway right, which they still continue to do. And these are unbelievable golfers that have so much talent and do it every day. Now, think about the average guy or gal. They don't put that much time, and they don't have the physical attributes that these people have. So how the heck are they going to play the game? And that's why the score has primarily stayed the same for men and women. With all this technology, new ball, all this stuff, scores are still really, really high.
Mm. I've always had a wrist hinge issue with my left hand. I'm right-handed, but my wrist is hinged. I'm just starting to get it under control here. But I've always found that the impact it had on me was that my club face would be open at impact, and so the ball would go right.
It comes with a right hand grab. They roll the club open. Okay, now that's a compensation that has to be dealt with on the downswing. So you got to roll the club closed, and who can roll it open and close it and get it right back to where they started?
Mm-hmm.
As they're moving at 70-80 miles an hour with a club head speed. I mean, it's all silly to think you can. So most people that roll it open and then close it hook the ball. In fact, that's how a lot of people, when they want to hook a ball, they'll fan it and then close it. And they'll get a little draw or close it quick to make it go around a corner. The correct way, I believe, is that when you hold the club in your hands, your left wrist should be bent and your right wrist should be flat. Okay? And what you want to do is you want to move that position at least past your right leg in the backswing. And you move it with the turning of your shoulders, which swings the arms back. Now, if you can get past that and just let the natural occurrence happen, what will happen is that the right wrist will go back a little bit and fold down like you're holding plates, depending on how much flexibility you have in the wrist. And the left wrist will flatten a bit. It may only hinge like you were hinging a club towards your nose, up and down. It may hinge or it may flatten a little bit. And that, again, depends on the way you have your hands on the club, flexibility of wrist, and so forth. And remember, the backswing is just the point where you're changing directions. So it's not you take the club up to a spot and stop and start. That's just, the golf swing is a continuous move. But to start the club back, you need to start it back slow. It has to have a rhythm, but it has to be slow. Because if you start fast, two things occur. You're going to grab it with the right hand, and you're going to pull that right wrist back, and you're going to bring that club back to the inside too soon. That's number one. And number two, when you have a fast backswing, you're always going to have a short backswing. Those two go together. Mm-hmm. So if you want to hit it a long ways, you have to have a wide backswing, and you have to take time. As I tell people, if you're going to shoot an arrow with a bow, you got to pull that bow all the way back. Well, there's a time period to do that. So you see people with these real short, fast swings, they hit it nowhere. And that's the majority of people that play because they're not sure what they want to do, so they get quick, they get it over with.
How would you advise someone to change their tempo and be conscious of it? I have a friend that I've been playing with for years that stands over the ball for almost 40 seconds. He just stares at the ball, and then all of a sudden, if you blink, you miss the entire swing. It is so fast. And he can't understand why he doesn't get better. And it's like, dude, slow down.
Well, yeah. First of all, he needs to have a pre-shot routine where he starts in from behind the ball.
Mm.
And then he goes to the golf ball, looks at the target, looks back at the ball. And as he's doing that, he's aligning himself and calming himself down. And then to start the tempo, a good way to start the tempo is start with like your right knee, kind of a kick in. It just kicks kind of in like a forward press. But you really want your body to set the tempo. You don't want your hands and arms to set the tempo because they'll get out of position immediately. In other words, they'll get across you and your chest hasn't moved. And now when your chest turns and your shoulders turn, your club's going to go way inside. So the sequence has to be more one piece. Now, I don't mind if the club head moves a little early, a little first, but I like to feel as if I set the tempo with the sternum of my chest. Some people like to set the tempo with their shoulders. But for God's sakes, you can't set the tempo with your hands because you'll start slow and then you'll yank it back because it just doesn't feel right. You've got to do this like you're winding up your body and not just taking your arms back. And I think that's a good thought, is that a slow wind of the body so that you can really get coiled. And now you've got some room to create momentum on the downswing.
How do you create the tempo or set the tempo from your sternum?
Well, I think about my chest turning, okay? So I just think the center of my chest. So I connect my arms And so imagine that my chest is a picture and my two arms are a frame of that picture. I try to keep that picture, the chest, between those two arms, okay? And so I focus on that picture. And I'm using this analogy because it's my picture. You know, other people might use their nose. I don't know, but I use that as it. And so I try to keep that picture inside that frame as I turn. So in doing so, I'm taking the address position, and I'm moving it to the right of me. And then the right arm pulls and puts the club in my throw position. But that's my process, because I've always been fast. I've been a Lanny Watkins kind of backswing. And if you have the talent of Lanny Watkins, you can get away with it, but I certainly don't, and most people don't. So what happens generally is you pull that baby inside too much.
You mentioned about putting the club head cover under your arm. Made me think about, I don't know if he's a disciple of yours, but I know he's a fan of yours, and that's Martin Chuck of Tour Striker out of Arizona. He's been on the show multiple times, and he developed the Tour Striker Club, and now he has a new product, that this little inflatable ball that you can either deflate it and put under your arms, or when you inflate it, you hold it between your arms so that they stay connected, right? And he talks about, he's been on the show multiple times, and he talks about you and your methods.
Well, you know, Martin, it's really funny. I was a member of, I was given an honorary membership at a club that Martin was the head pro at here in the desert. And, I always try to stay away, out of the way of the pro shop and all that, because I felt a little guilty. I wasn't paying any dues. I wasn't paying any membership fees. So I was always the back of the range when I played. And this happened late in my life, so I wasn't a great player or anything. Martin, and I liked Martin very much. He's really a gentleman, a really nice young guy, but at that time, we didn't really get social, because I always, like I said, I always felt like, I hope he doesn't think I'm going to be trying to give lessons out here, or I'm after a job or anything like that, because a lot of pros feel that way. Martin, as it turned out, didn't have that kind of a thought in his mind. But one day he asked me if I would play in a junior-senior event with him. And I said, sure. But part of me said, oh, man, I don't want to shoot 80. Because, like I say, this is end of my golf career. So we get paired with two of the best players in Southern California. One guy's going on the tour. One guy just got off the senior tour. That was their team against us. We started the first hole. We tied them. But they had blasted their balls out there 50 yards past both of us. And then we started. It was a shotgun event. We started on the ninth hole. And then it was like a crazy thing. I made a birdie on 10 and 11, par 12. Birdie 13, par 14, had a hole in one at 15.
Whoa.
Birdie 16. Yeah. And I shot like 29 or 28 on the back nine.
Oh, my God.
And Martin
gosh.
Said, what are you doing out here? Martin says, somebody should put up a plaque right now, because a miracle is occurring. Well, anyway, long story short, I think I shot one under on the back, and Martin shot two or three under on the other side, I should say. And we win the tournament going away. I mean, it wasn't even a contest. The two guys were playing with, the looks on their faces was, I wish I had that picture, because it was just classic. And they figured, especially on the first hole, after they drove it out there about 310 each, and we're out there about 260, well, we're going to get rid of these guys real quick. And as it turned out, we won the tournament. So, Martin and I, we've laughed about that tournament. And only time we ever played together, okay? And we've never really talked about the golf swing. But I watch Revolutionary Golf every now and then, and Martin's on there,
yeah,
and or on your site, and we talk the same language. We believe in the same thing. And as ironic as this is, I hadn't seen Martin for years. I went to Lake Tahoe last summer with my gal, and one of my clients belonged to a golf course up there. And when I walk in, Gus Jones, who I know very well from the desert, is a head pro, and Martin Chuck is a teaching pro, and I just about fell over. So we had a big laugh over that. But he's a great guy, really a very, very fine golfer. I mean, and if you want to watch learn the golf swing, just look at what he's doing. And that Tour Striker thing that he created is genius. It really is.
Do you like that? Do you like that product and what it how it teaches you to come down on the ball?
Well, I'm sure I like it, and the only thing is, I will say that it's for the average guy, it's very hard because the average guy doesn't do it right.
Yeah,
doesn't get he's got that handle behind the club at an impact, so the head's coming up, so he's not going to get the ball airborne. And I must say, the first time I did it, I just shot it down about a foot off the ground. I thought, what the heck? But then Al Geiberger was the first one that had one, and he brought it over to me and said, you got to try this. And then after, my correct swing kicked in, I started hitting the ball up in here, and I thought, God, this is terrific. And, it must be a good product. You sold 10 trillion of them, I think.
Yeah, he's having fun with that. Well, I'm curious to go back to this tournament that the two of you played together, because recently in a conversation with Mark Brody about Every Shot Counts, his book, and we were talking about golf metrics and how he's saying that statistics show that the drive for show, putt for dough is actually backwards, that you really, if you hit the ball longer and farther, you're going to have lower scores. Well, I should say longer and straighter. You're going to have lower scores because you're coming into the green with shorter irons, which are going to, increase your chances of hitting the green. What was the key? What is it about you guys not hitting the ball far, you got a hole in one, but what is it that beat them, and what can we learn from that?
What really happened, I kind of, after the first tee shot, which was mediocre at best, I kind of felt something. It was like a little pre-cocked position at address. You know how things happen. And I started, because I was playing from the senior tees, I started keeping it up with this fellow, and on occasion even knocked it past him. And I think I rattled him a little bit because, on the first tee shot, he got me by at least 50 yards. So that was part of it. And then my iron play just got stupid good. I was just drilling it in there. And I was laughing, truthfully laughing to myself, like, when is this bubble going to burst? And just to think about this, how about going hole-in-one birdie? Okay. Yeah, I mean, usually you go hole-in-one triple bogey because
right.
You're excited. But it just, I guess I kind of got out of my own way. And I was in an overdrive when I got that feeling that no matter what I did, it was going to be good. And, that they call that the zone. I have a 15 or 20 foot putt, bam, in the hole, 10 foot putt, bam, in the hole, 5 foot putt, bam, in the hole. They just went crazy. And then when I got a little bit conscious of it, when you shoot under 30, and then went to the other side, I had started with a par. I had 8 holes to go. I had a tough time because I was conscious. I wanted to shoot some, your ego gets so blown out of proportion. I think that was 1 under or something like that. But that 1-9 was magic. It was just, I thought, well, this is what it must feel like to be Tiger Woods or whoever, because, it was just simple. It was just absolutely simple. Getting back to what you said about something, I'd like to bring something up.
Sure.
From my past. Years ago, I was training some ladies on the LPGA. When I was at Mission Hills, and because they had the Kraft Nabisco at that time, and I became a big fan of ladies golf because I saw how great they hit the golf ball, but they couldn't hit it very far compared to a man. And I started thinking about it way back when they had a tournament. I can't even remember the name of it, but it was a man and a woman against a man and a woman. So just for the fun of it, I started using the computer and looking at the distance that women hit the drive and also the second shot. And when I looked at what the ladies' tour was, hardly anybody was reaching par fives and two, and they were hitting long irons and sometimes fairway woods to the par fours. Well, the men were hitting drives, 8 irons, 7 irons right in there all the time, and the long hitters were a lot of, with the par fours, you drive and wedge. So I compiled a distance advantage that I thought women should have over men. And I wanted to set up a men tournament a women against men tournament. Hmm. And we came up with 75-yard distance. And I knew Sandra Palmer and some of the gals from the Nabisco and told them about it. And we went over to a golf course. And at that time, I could pop it out there 300 yards plus. So I played from the back tees, and then I moved the gals up 75 yards. And we hit our tee shots, and well, heck, they were still ahead of me, even if I busted it, because they needed to be, because they needed to hit. If I was going to hit an 8-iron, I hit an 8-iron at that time about 165, 170. They would have to be able to hit an 8-iron from their distance, probably about like 150 or 145. So they needed that distance advantage also in the second shot. So it worked out great, and we played 9 holes, and they were all, 5 under, and they, very excited. 31s, 32s for par 36. So I got some people interested in my concept, and they said, well, we'll fund that. It's Culinary Workers Union. And I went to the PGA with the idea. I can't think of the name of the guy then, but he was a good player. He was an attorney with glasses. And he immediately said, no, we would never do that because we have nothing to gain. So I came back with my tail between my legs, and I met with Commissioner Ray Volpe, who was a commissioner for the LPGA at the time. And we talked about it, and I said, well, there is one chance we could do the thing in December when there is no tour. We could do it like an old twerk dance. We'll have the gals invite the guys. So my friends that were sponsoring the thing, the Hotel Workers Union, they got the Doral Country Club. Mm. And we had the gals invite, boy, Sandra Palmer invited, Arnold Palmer. And anyway, we had Trevino Palmer. We had everybody. And we did this tournament. And it was a rousing success. Didn't have it on regular television. We had it on PBS. But everybody really enjoyed the event, but they didn't play men against women, but they did give the gals a 75-yard distance advantage. The second year, Frank Sinatra, who I knew very well, said, I'd like to sponsor that tournament, and I'll bring Sears Roebuck in, which he did. And, long story short, just before the tournament was going to be announced, Mr. Sinatra's mom was in a jet plane to go see him in Vegas, and they flew right into the Santa Rosa Mountains here in the desert. Wow. She died, and he had to back out of the tournament, and of course Sears went with him. So there I am now, and I spent more money than I had trying to promote this thing and make the appearance of success, fancy car, clothes, so because I was meeting with the Actors Equity, which was Mr. Sinatra's charities, and it's for actors that are down on their luck. They either pay for their medical bills or so forth. Well, when I got the word from Mr. Sinatra's people that, he couldn't announce, obviously, when mom died, and all that. LPGA grabbed the tournament with the PGA, and they had waiting in the wings, they had JCPenney's, and that's when it became the JCPenney's Mixed Team Championship. And out of, I think they played somewhere in Florida, like Tampa or someplace like that. It was on TV for about 14 years. And everybody said, well, you got to sue. That was your idea, and you have all this paperwork. And I said, look, I was trying to promote ladies' golf. I don't give a damn about suing anybody. I feel like I should have been, given a pat on the back or a gold watch or something. But the key thing that I'm bringing this up about is not so much that I lost the term, but the disparity between men and women's golf is distance. Mm-hmm. It's not ability. Believe me when I tell you, the gals can hit the hell out of the golf ball, and they can. I think there's a few gals out there that I'll put against the men in putting any day. But you can't overcome the distance. And, when Michelle Wee was coming out when she's 14 and doing so well, and people were saying she's going to go on the tour, they interviewed me. And I said, look, I could go lift weights for 10 years, and then you put me in a cage with a bear or a lion or whatever, and they're going to tear me apart. That's nature. And although Michelle Wee is a wonderful little gal and she hits the ball really good, she can't compete with a man. I mean, don't be stupid. That's all that garbage. And I think the people that were pushing that hurt her. They put a lot of pressure on that girl. And I'm so happy to see her playing great golf again. But there's a distance difference. And when you say, is there an advantage hitting long? Sure there is. Of course there is. If I've got an 8-iron into the green, you've got 4-iron into the green, and we're somewhat the same, I'm going to beat your brains out. I mean, it just goes less. Well, it's just science. I mean, it's just math. It's an easier shot. So you're absolutely right when you say that does mean something. But distance isn't everything. And that was proven this year when we were in the regional championship. I had a boy that could hit it 340 off the tee with no doubt, but we played a real tight little golf course where you can't hit driver. They just the designer just love you to hit driver so you can knock it out of bounds. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, he only hit 3 drivers out of bounds. So that's craziness. There is a point where you have to look at what the hole is, and then you have to say, okay, this is what I must do. I'm going to take double and triple and all that out of play by doing this. That's managing yourself on the golf course. That's what I try to teach my players. Sometimes they listen, and sometimes they don't. But distance is an advantage to a point.
So now on the women's tour, we have an 11-year-old who's making headlines.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's wonderful, actually. It's really wonderful.
Tell me what you know about her and what you've seen and what your thoughts are about someone who can compete at that level at that age.
Well, I saw that she had won the pitch and putt thing, or was one of the winners at Augusta, and then turns around and gets on the tour or gets in a qualifier for the U.S. Open and makes it for the ladies. It doesn't surprise me, Fred. I've got a 15-year-old by the name of June Jang that found my video. I started her when she was a little past 12. And recently she played in a major event in, it was called a Silver Bell event, I think in Phoenix somewhere. And she shot 74, 64, 70 against 26-year-olds. And just recently she played in the Golf Week magazine tournament. The previous year she had shot 67, 71 to win it. And this year she shot 75 with a triple, par 5, which she tried to go into when there's water on both sides, and she learned a good lesson. But then she came back with 68. And she said, Coach, I hit every green. And she said, I missed so many putts, I could have had 59 today. And it wouldn't shock me if she said, Coach, I shot 59 today. That's how good these kids are nowadays. What they're doing is, when it used to take us 10 years, they're compressing that into a year. Because they're practicing every single day. They got a wedge or a putter in their hand all the time. They're not thinking about music, hairdos, nothing. All they're thinking about is how to get the ball in the hole. There's a mindset out there with a lot of young kids that just love the sport. But it's like what happened when the Beatles came out. Every mom and dad wanted to give their kid a guitar to learn because they saw a chance for fame. And I think that's what's happening. Young people are starting to really discover golf. And, you're like a rock star, for God's sakes, if you're really good in golf, if you're a star. You know, we see in the men's tour, well, the same thing's going to happen to the women's. The women's will never be as popular as men's because that's just how life is. But if you want to see quality golf, watch the women play. It's unbelievable, and they're getting longer. And when you read these stories about 11-year-olds making it, it's just great for golf and women's golf especially. But more importantly, it's great for juniors, for a kid to see, my God, an 11-year-old make it. Mom, get me a wedge. Buy me a set of clubs. We know that it takes a lot of hard work, and you have to be a special kind of person to get all the way to the tour. But it's still, this is such a great sport. It's such a great sport for a kid. It's a lifelong sport. It teaches you so many great lessons. And hey, every now and then out of a batch of kids, you get one that's so special. Like June is to me. I mean, she's like my daughter. I mean, I just adore her. And she is such a hard worker. I had a couple of big universities call. I don't want to mention their names. But they're already looking at her, and she's a sophomore. fantastic. So it didn't surprise me. I mean, it did a little bit, but I didn't say, oh, my God, that's not possible, because it is possible.
Sure.
When you go to some of these AJGA events and some of the things that the PGA does, and they should be so thanked for doing that. And you see the talent that's out there. It's mind-boggling. I've got a 7-year-old that I'm teaching right now, and I want to tell you something. He's got as correct a golf swing as anybody on tour. I mean, it's perfect. It's perfect. And he beats the ball out there way farther than a 7-year-old should hit it. And what's he going to be doing when he's 15 or 16 if he continues this? And all he can think about is he watches the Golf Channel. He doesn't watch SpongeBob. it's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. And I love it. I just love it.
So the 15-year-old, if I'm not mistaken, is it Jiyun Zhang?
Jiyun Zhang, and she's on my video. And the swing that she had is tighter and better than it was then. It was pretty darn good then.
Because at the end of 2013, you sent me a couple of video clips of her swing. And I will definitely put those up on the blog post with this show. But you also sent me the video of the 7-year-old boy. What's his name?
Ivan Tran.
Ivan Tran? Okay, I'll put those up so people can see what you're talking about. Because you can see their swing. They're short videos. They're real quick. It's just the kid swing. But
you just look at the swing and say, holy mackerel.
Yeah.
How the heck did he do that? And in Ivan's case, I can't take credit for his swing because he watched the Golf Channel and copied it.
So
when his dad came to me and said, would you help my son? And I hadn't seen him hit the ball on the range, because every time he comes out there, he draws a crowd. I said, you've done a great job with him. He says, oh, he won't listen to me anymore. I cracked up at 7 years old. You know? But the truth is the dad doesn't play golf. And the kid knows that. So, I want to tell you something. I would pay to give this kid lessons, and I don't charge kids, but I would pay to give this little kid lessons, because it's looking at a phenomenon in the future. I mean, this kid's going to do something in golf. It's going to be crazy. And he putts and chips like a pro. I mean, already. He gets on the putting green, and you'll see all people putting, and everybody stops because they see him roll one after another, 20-footer, one right after another, bam. And I just sit there and just watch. The ball just keeps going in the hole. He thinks that's what's supposed to happen. It's fabulous. It really is fabulous.
Well, so I've always been fascinated by young people who come up on the tour because it's golf is well beyond physical skills. There's the mental aspect. There's the emotional aspect of dealing with the pressure of a Sunday round. And, I'm thinking a 7-year-old, he's going to bang it away. He doesn't even know or understand what it means to have the pressure on, with all the eyes watching and got to make this putt. How is the mental side for, I mean, these kids can hit balls like crazy all day long, but put them on a golf course in competition, what happens then?
Oh, Ivan has played in a number of tournaments, which he's won or been in second place.
Yeah, but he's competing against 7-year-olds, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah. This is the thing that I think that is happening, like this 11-year-old, they see they can do it. They enjoy doing it, and they love people watching them do it. Mm. So they don't have the insecurities and the feelings, well, can I beat this? They don't even think that way. It's a totally different way of thinking. And I think it's just the era we're in, kids are out of their shell really early because of television and whatever. Think back when you were a kid, and things you did and what's happening today, because of, and I don't think it's all good, don't get me wrong, but because of Facebook and everything, everyone is more involved in the social aspect. So people have a tendency to be a little bit more, they're not so self-conscious. And, I'm such a wallflower. I mean, I remember going to a dance when I was a sophomore, and I was literally stuck against the wall, afraid to ask anybody to dance. That doesn't occur anymore. I mean, that doesn't occur anymore because of the exposure that they have to everything. So kids don't have that fear that I think we had, because that's just how it was.
Well, so they're in front of cameras a whole lot more than we ever were. I mean, there's no pictures of me growing up, but every young person I know, and I'm talking under 10, is so comfortable in front of a camera because there's being pictures being taken every few minutes.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this period of time now is where people are showing off a lot. They're showing off the way they look, the way they dress. Everyone's conscious of all these things. So, I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't a few kids that still walk around hung up on this and hung up on that, but the majority are much more confident, I know, than when I was a kid. Of course, I went to parochial school, and it was pretty strict. But these kids nowadays, I mean, the boys that come in my programs, I mean, they're already, they've had experiences in their life that I didn't have until I was in my 30s, you know, some good, some bad. But they've just been exposed to a hell of a lot more than I was. And so consequently, they think more adult. They have more adult feelings in the sense of what they think about themselves. And I can tell you, Ivan, if I tell Ivan, hey, come on, I want you to hit a drive for my boy's golf team, he can't wait to show them that he hits it better than them. he can't wait.
Let's get back to mechanics for a minute, because I wanted to ask you, because it's been asked of me about your methods. The swing for your short game, for pitching and chipping and not full swing, how is that impacted by what your method is?
Well, you know, the chipping method has always been that you play off, if you're right-handed, you put the majority of your weight on your left side. So that falls right back into what we're doing. And modern-day chippers are less handsy. They're more arm, shoulder, weight left. And then a small rotation, and the rotation gets bigger for the longer the shot. But there's a rotation, so they keep the arms connected, and it's still a body movement opposed to just the arms. Not to say that you can't do it with just the arms, but again, when you're using arms and hands, you're bringing in the opportunity for the hands to overwork or for you to decelerate your arms. Where you stay connected and you turn through it, the club is moving along with the body, so there's no hit to the ball kind of thing. You have to be on the left side for sure, because you want the club to be coming down when it strikes the golf ball. So that's part of it. It's not difficult for sure. It's not difficult. So I think chipping.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, and then of course I teach the Paul Runyon type of chip stroke, so chipping where you're on the fringe and shortcut of the grass, you know, you're going to do that with 7, 8, 6 irons. You're not going to be using sand wedge on those kind of shots. Pitching when you're in the further back and heavier grass where the club has to come up down, but you're still on the left side. That's just more of what I say, a body swing. Though the real chipping, where you set up to the ball and you take the heel of the club off the ground, so you put it up on its toe. And the reason you do that is because you want to get the shaft in the same position as your putter shaft, so you get your eyes right down over the ball. Then you're just using an arm swing with a flat left wrist, very similar to your putting stroke. And that should be done around the green. You know, put away your wedges around the green. You want to hit the ball and let it release and roll to the hole. You don't want to try to put backspin on all that. It's just silliness. But when you're pitching the ball from a distance, you know, 30 yards, 40 yards, then you have to use a miniature rotary motion, just like you do with the full swing. Real simple.
Oh yeah, sure. Real simple.
No, it really is. I honestly, for those of you that have chipping problems or anything like that, you ever come to the desert, I'll get rid of them in 5 balls. I mean, I promise you. And I don't care if you scoop it right at the bottom or anything. I teach some PE classes, beginners, and a lot of these people have never touched a golf club in their life. And in a very short period of time, everybody's got that handle ahead of the ball at impact, and
It looks great, but it's not hard to do. But it's hard to do if you're trying to keep your wrist flat and your body still and your head still and you're pushing your arms, and then it's really hard. Then you're sculling them across the green all day long. But that's not the action. You have to set up properly and you have to understand what the movement is. But then once you get the movement, it's really simple.
Oh, boy, do I want to see that. I'm bringing the video camera for that one.
Okay, man. Anytime. This is really duck soup. This is a simple part of the game. The only thing is the distance control. That's the hard part about chipping and putting.
If you
have a 20-foot putt, you got to be able to hit it 21 feet. But, or 22 feet at most.
Yeah, but most of the time I see the mistakes that happen for chipping is that people hit 3 or 4 inches behind the ball. And then club head bounces.
That's because they're staying behind the ball. They're not moving through the ball, number one. Or they're trying to scoop under the ball, try to get under the ball and make it go up. You'll hear people say, they'll scull and they say, I didn't get under that one. Well, you don't get under it. You're hitting, you have to hit down on it. And the ball hits the face of the club, slides up the face, and then goes up in the air. But you don't scoop the club underneath. The only shot that I know that you go underneath like that is a sand shot when you lay the club back. But people try to do that. They feel like they have to help it up. And so in scooping, you have to uncock your wrist. Your left wrist gets really cocked and the blade goes up. So that's the banana, you know. But it's easily fixed. Once people, you don't say, don't scoop your wrist. You just show them, a movement where the wrist don't scoop. You explain how the thing really works, and then it's really easy. The problem is that a lot of teachers that teach say don't do this. Well, no, you see you scooped it, or you did this, and so they're still fixated on that movement instead of getting them to do the movement that eliminates that. But really, honestly, if anybody wants to chip, they can go on any website. There's so many guys out there that are saying exactly what I say, because it's not a secret. And you know, keep in mind the tour is constantly looking for the easiest way to do these things, not the hardest. So if you copy Mickelson or those kind of people, you'll see that they have a process that they repeat over and over again.
But why? That's where more strokes are lost, I think, inside the 30-yard area than anything else.
Oh, there's no
else.
Question about it. Yeah, no question about it. I one of the parts of my formula for the golf team is that you've got to be able to get it up and down from 50 yards and in. You just got to be able to do that. If you're serious about being a competitive golfer, you have to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And it sounds really hard, but it's really not, because once you have a motion that is consistent, then you just can dial in the rotation of your body for the distance. When you do it with your hands, now, you know, your nerve endings are at the end of the fingers, and we all get nervous, and we all get anxious, and that never goes away, and hopefully never will, because that's a good thing. Adrenaline is a good thing if you use it properly. But if you set up to the ball properly, whether you're hitting the ball, chipping the ball, whatever, and you, now your body dictates the distance the ball is going to go by its rotation and tempo, well, you can fine tune this thing really quick, opposed to trying to time your hands, when they turn over, how fast they turn over, and so forth. And those are the things that the modern swing, even though this is not really a modern swing, but it's a modern way of teaching. You watch the tour now. You look at the guys when they step to the ball. You don't see anybody way behind the ball in a dress anymore. You know, there was a guy by the name of Jerry Hogan that said, I want you to stand above the ball, but not behind it. And that's a great statement. And that's with the driver or anything else.
Interesting.
You're going to have to come down and bring your wedge, a suitcase, a toothbrush, and a wedge.
It's going to be a long weekend. Okay, suitcase, a toothbrush, and a wedge. Well,
yeah, maybe an 8-iron so that I can show you the run-up shot too.
I'll bring the putter, and we'll just play the entire round with 3 clubs. How's that?
Yeah, there you go. Absolutely.
That'll be interesting. I'd probably score the same.
probably. probably.
Oh, Tony, well, listen, I hope you have a full recovery. I'm so sorry about your accident, and I know that I haven't asked in a while. How old are you now?
I'm 77.
Oh, my gosh.
But right now, when I had the accident, I felt 97.
Yeah, I bet.
Because you're all of a sudden you're saying, oh, I'm falling now because I'm old. But what happened to me, if I was 15, I would have got the same result, unfortunately, because the golf course, I wonder what will happen if another member gets down there where I was and then tries to walk up that hill and slips. The result's going to be very similar because it shouldn't be that steep anywhere near the green. But that's another story. I know a lot of people say, well, are you going to sue? And I'm not a suing type. I think God had that plan for me to teach me patience because I get a little impatient. My girlfriend is looking at me now, kind of nodding her head. anyway, you know, I have to look at it as it gave me some time to stop working 7 days a week. Mm. And I caught up on every TV show that exists for sure. But that's not something
you want to brag about.
No, it's just behind me now. And like I say, once I get through therapy, I'll be kicking and running again, just like I always do.
Just like you always do. And dragging that team with you across the finish line ahead of everybody else.
Hopefully we can keep that up, baby.
Oh, amazing. All right, Tony. Well, it was great to talk to you again. Thank you so much for giving us your time. The Golf Smarter community loves you, will always love you. And again, the book and the DVD, The Lost Fundamental by Tony Manzoni, is right here on our website. And, I like to say this, and it's hard, but you're not going to find it anywhere else. Really, you could look everywhere on the web. You're only going to find it here. And so, and that's why you're getting such, the response from people all over the world. So,
well, I just want to thank everyone listening and leave them this thought that please continue supporting Fred. You are the voice of golf, as far as I'm concerned, and I think you're doing a wonderful, wonderful thing for a lot of people.
You using Twitter these days? Well, you can follow us at Golf Smarter. Hashtag sound advice. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.